And there were a lot of people looking in 1971. Jim Broyhill looked at the Senate race, and some of his folks talked to me about running for Congress since I was in that district, with the idea that he might run for the Senate and Gardner run for governor. And as for Jesse got really geared up, just still talking about it at that point. In fact, I think Jesse had only changed his registration maybe in the summer of 71. Not sure about that time. Whatever it is, it's a fact. Mm-hmm. And Gardner really didn't start looking at things till about the time of the Republican State Convention. He started talking seriously about that. And we had had a fundraising dinner in October sometime or another. But at that point, it was still so much in the air. We had some bumper strips, but they just said Holzhauser. It didn't even say what it was for. And I guess it still could have gone for the Senate at that point, or for Congress if Broyhill decided to go for the Senate. But when Gardner decided to start looking at it, you know, he told me he was interested. And I encouraged him not to do it. And I didn't know how it was going to turn out, because I knew he had been very popular with the party in 68, won the Republican primary going away. But I also knew a lot of the party chairmen and people who had worked in the vineyards, and felt like that I could count on them for support. And we went after a lot of people that I knew who had supported him in 68 in the primary, and got a lot of them to be our county manager, so to speak. Very, very difficult campaign. First poll we took, matter of fact, only poll we took, showed we were down 2-1, something like 50-25 or something like that. And I'm still convinced that if every Republican in the state had voted on primary day, I'd probably lost. But again, I always had this sort of scientific approach that you look where people turn out to go vote, and you figure out how many votes it's going to take, and you try to give quotas to each county and each precinct, and then you figure out where you got to spend your time and what little money you had. We didn't have any money. And rely a little bit on Gardner's overconfidence, because he had to be seeing the same polls we were. And so he didn't do any attack ads or anything. And so it came out as a total shock to his folks, I think, and to him, but sort of pulling out our best hopes when the first primary finished.
As you look towards the general election and the race against Skipper Bowles, how did you see your chances?
Well, it was sort of interesting. The day after the first primary was over, I remember having this terrible letdown feeling that I was going to have to campaign and go back to campaigning immediately for another 30 days. And also feeling very stunned was how the Democrat primary had come out, because we had counted on running against Pat Taylor the whole time. And that meant you had to go into a whole new kind of thinking on the assumption that if you did win, you're going to have to go about this entirely differently than you would have it. As it turned out, we really didn't, because basically you ran as the candidate of change, and wrapped the Democrat Party label around Skipper, even though he had been the outsider candidate in the Democrat primary. We benefited, and we didn't know for sure how it would come out. We benefited from the fact that the Bowles people didn't go out of their way to heal the primary wounds. But most of all, I think we just benefited from the fact that George McGovern was on the ticket for the Democrats. And when your candidate for president gets 70% of the vote, you obviously got a starting edge. And we didn't win by 40,000 votes or so. So, the fact that my wife got out and worked really hard, the fact that we got a better percentage of the black vote, we got some union vote of all things for a Republican. We got some strong vote support from the teachers. And the Helms campaign and my campaign, I think, complemented each other as it turned out. And we put all of them under one umbrella with Nixon, Helms, and Holzhauser in the fall. And same staff working all three campaigns. So it was one of those things, a lot of things had to come right and come together, and they did.
Right. One quick question before I ask, and a few questions about Helms' campaign in 72. Did your camp make any overt effort to draw in Reginald Hawkins supporters?
I don't think so. Reggie had been out on the fringe a little bit, and his folks I didn't think were likely to come our way. We pulled some different elements in, and you know, we'd had some ties with the Indians down in Robeson County, from having helped them get some economic development started. We had some young blacks in Greensboro and several other places like that. And we had some entrees into a number of the black committees. And in some cases, I think I was the first Republican that ever come talk to them. And while in a lot of cases we didn't get their support, I always had the feeling maybe they didn't work quite as hard against us. I ought to say, too, this in terms of coming back to Skipper's thing. The one thing that obviously came out of the primaries, too, was that Skipper got overexposed in the primary. Their media strategist, Walter Vries, and his pollster, Lance Terrence, at least I think Lance was his pollster, I'm not sure, but Walter, I know, was involved, set out media markets, very scientifically well-developed campaign plan. You took the polls in each media market, saw what they said, and you threw out the TV to do it. But he got overexposed in the process, and I have always believed that had they not started their television in the fall until maybe a couple of weeks before the election, he would have won. Because we would have had to spend money we didn't have. As a result, he started about 6 weeks ahead, and that overexposure picked right back up, and I think his money was actually helping us by the end. I had one lady down in South Carolina send us a check. They told me about it anyway, that with a note saying, "I'm so tired of seeing Skipper Bowles on TV, I just decided I'd send you some money."
on that point, I want to ask, how did you put together your media program for that campaign?
Well, we knew we were going to have a very, very limited budget. I mean, the whole campaign was two primaries and a general election was run on less than $400,000. And we had raised only about $200,000 of that at the time of Election Day in the fall. And the television money you can't buy on credit. The time you can't buy on credit. So what we did was to try to set up a strategy of trying to get as much free media as we could through the 6 o'clock news. I'm not sure they let you do that anymore, but we tried to be somewhere in a media market where we could get by and do an interview with somebody, you know, in the Triad or the Triangle or Charlotte or Asheville or Wilmington every day. And, you know, they would call and say I was going to be in town and could be there at 3 o'clock or 3:30, but they wanted to do an interview. And with local news and a gubernatorial thing, we never got turned down as far as I know. And so we did a lot of that. And we did a lot of sort of media event type things. We got everybody in a three or four vans and took them out to where Highway 64 east of Raleigh went up to the top of a bridge at Wendell and just stopped. The Wendell bypass had been on the drawing board for better than 20 years and hadn't been finished. We talked about highway planning and how we needed it. And we we invited the press to come watch the makings of TV commercials, some of which I don't think ever got run. We rented $1 million from one of the banks for an hour and had them bring it out to WRAL to the studio and put it in a bathtub and pull up leaves of tobacco and soft drinks talking about the taxes that Bowles had voted for. And we got far more exposure about the free from the free TV, I think, than we did from the ads. Got good newspaper coverage on it, too. And it was, we had some people who understood our financial circumstances and several consultants who came in. Roger Ailes came in and helped. A couple of his people had helped in campaigns up in Kentucky in similar situations. And they had a lot of good ideas to how to maximize your money. And they were good advisors on how to conduct yourself in the interviews with the media as well. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about, you got to sound like you know what you're talking about, whether you do or not. Because it's a case of almost not what you say, but how you go about saying it, that you have confidence in what you're saying and that you sound honest and sincere. And I told them they didn't have to worry about it. I was going to know what I said, and I was going to be honest and sincere. They just had to teach me how to sound like that.
Tell me about your thinking at the time of the significance of Jesse Helms and what he represented as a political force and his emergence in that same election cycle.
Well, you know, we talked about the Barry Goldwater campaign of 64 and Gardner's involvement 66 and 68. I think the stream that was running through North Carolina politics simply got taken to the next level when Jesse ran in 72. And you never know what North Carolina politics would have been like since then had he not been in that race. Might have just been totally different. And, you know, we saw a lot of each other crossing campaign paths and all, but the campaigns, you just don't run a campaign for governor the same way you run a campaign for Senate and vice versa. So that we had common staff. Field men were working for the three people on the ticket, which blended them all together and particularly down the stretch helped make sure that we were maximizing our exposure and rallies and that sort of thing. But it was a different strategy. Jesse aimed more in the east where he had more exposure on television, and we were concentrating on isolated, again, going back to that old theory of where the boats are, where we knew that Republicans had run well before in the east, and then concentrating primarily on the Piedmont. We spent some time in the mountains simply because as a mountaineer I felt like that I could pull more from the mountains, but it's have to be realistic about that, because when you look at the vote in the mountains, you can't see this on your tape, but you've got a certain vote that is locked in to both parties. Straight Democrat vote, straight Republican vote. And there's a higher percentage of that vote in the mountains than there is in the Piedmont. So you knew that you were playing for it to maximize your vote as a mountaineer, but realizing that the ducks were still in the Piedmont.
As I did earlier in our conversation, let me tick off a few parts of a political program. This is
all right.
These are the things which, after your 4 years in Raleigh, in the governor's mansion, these are the things which you typically and consistently pointed to as the chief accomplishments of your tenure. Things like a general improvement of governmental efficiency and integrity, significant educational improvements, teacher pay, class size reductions, the kindergarten effort, significant moves on the environment. You bought a tremendous amount of parkland for the state. You got the Coastal Areas Management Act through. You got the new river taken care of. You launched an initiative in rural health care, established a system of rural health clinics. You expanded the mental health program considerably. And you achieved significant economic expansion and capital investment in the state, although through a program that included certain environmental safeguards for new industry coming in. Now, Governor, if you took that program out today, somebody might call you not a liberal Republican but a liberal Democrat. And I'm wondering, I say that, and I mean to be just good-natured. It's interesting that the politics that was at the center of your Republican term in the early and mid-70s has shifted so much. And I wonder if you can talk me through what you think are the principal reasons for the fundamental realignment of ideological politics in the Republican Party in these 20 years.
Well, it's... it's a little hard to know everything. At the time, some of those things were done. They were addressed at problems that the state faced then and probably other states faced also. I mean, we were probably out front of most states where the Coastal Area Management Act was concerned. I think there had been one other state that had done something along that up in New England. And I get credit in some corners for that, but at the same time, there was a study commission that was formed in 71, I guess, that reported back in 73. So it was something I inherited in a sense. It was something that made sense to me, though, and the fact that it was coming from Democrats was one of those things you just didn't let get in the way. Willis Wichard, who had been very involved in that now in the Supreme Court, was spearheading that in the Senate. He and I had been good friends a long time, and we talked about it a lot. And I told him that I thought I could get the Republicans from the mountains and the Piedmont to support it. And if he could get the Democrats from the Piedmont and the mountains to support it, because there wasn't going to be much support from it from the coastal plain. Turned out to be exactly right. And even then, we had to give and give and give a lot in order to get the bill that finally passed. Now, that's been 20 years, and since that time, people have had a lot of chance to see how that worked. In some cases, it's worked extremely well. In other cases, people have come away feeling like that the ratio of cost and benefit has not justified some of the regulation that was imposed. And I share that in some cases. At the same time, you could see the potential for the coast to be really trashed if we didn't do something. I felt the same way about the mountains, but I couldn't get my Republicans from the mountains to go with me on that, and we lost it because the legislators from the coast weren't having anything to do with that either. And the only thing we've had since then was the Ridge Law, and I still regret that. I think the mountains would be better off today if we'd had something. Some of my Republican friends don't agree with that because most of them tend to be laissez-faire type people. But on your point about where the party has gone, I think there's been an element that began folk emerging in the late 80s and early 90s that is now coming more and more to the fore of people who say the less government the better. You see it nationally, you see it in North Carolina. My philosophy has been slightly different than that, in that I always believe that Lincoln's philosophy of government ought to do for people what they can't do as well for themselves ought to be the polar star around which you work. And during the time of Abraham Lincoln, there was much less that government needed to do than there is in the 1990s. At the same time, people, I think Republicans' attitudes tend to reflect the feeling of a lot of people on the street that government has gotten too much involved in their lives, too many regulations, and ironically, you don't hear a lot of conversation about it, but part of it, too, is that the increase in the amount of the average person's wage or income that's going into Social Security is making everybody feel like that even if you got all the deductions in the world, you still got to pay all this Social Security. And it's made people feel like the government has been just been oppressive. And so it has been a I would not view the change in the party today as opposed to what it was in the 1970s as an emergence of a different set of ideals as opposed to these ideals over here, but simply it reflects a difference in time and events. And the 96 elections will probably tell us a lot about whether the Republicans in Congress in particular have misread the public mood. If the Republicans' program is adopted and it gets in place and people decide, well, maybe this is a pretty good thing, the public mood is probably going to be supportive of that in 1996. Otherwise, it won't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me step back now to 72 and talk in some of the detail about how all of this has come to pass. What was your relationship as governor to Helms and the Helms wing? And in particular, I guess, the emerging Congressional Club founded in 73.
Now, the Congressional Club was just embryonic, and during most of the time I was in Raleigh, and we didn't have a lot of contact. And, you know, Jesse was doing his thing in Washington. I was doing my thing in Raleigh, and we talked to each other on the phone occasionally, and I met with the congressional delegation in Washington, had all them at the governor's mansion once, talk about things like natural gas and the shortage and that sort of thing, federal issues that have impacted on the state. But for the most part, it was sort of a different game going on, two people playing in different ballparks.
Did you anticipate the coming fracture even then?
Well, there were a lot of people who had supported Jesse and had supported me. I mean, those things have never been mutually exclusive, that you can draw on the drawing board and that newspapers can write about, and sometimes they do. But fact is that a lot of people supported the Congressional Club who also supported me, and I never got out and fought the Congressional Club. Only time we differed significantly during the time I was in Raleigh was in the Republican presidential primary of 76. And I think that brought things to a head in a way that left things bruised for several years.
I want to ask a couple questions about that. But first, did you know Tom Ellis well?
Pretty well. He had been actively involved in the Republican Party group in Raleigh during the time I was state chairman. And good strategist, excellent strategist. And still have high regard for him in that.
Did he back you in 72 or Gardner?
I don't know who he voted for. I'm sure he didn't get out in front for either one of us because he was concentrating on Jesse and Jesse's primary.
when 76 rolled around and as you just mentioned, Reagan with Congressional Club backing upsets Ford in the state GOP primary. What do you think really explained that development? What factors explained Reagan's success?
I think that's been fairly well cataloged. I think Tom persuaded the national Reagan people to do a television blitz the last 3 or 4 days before the primary that turned the tide around. Although, coming back to my scientific way of doing things, I think if every Republican had voted, Ford would have carried the state. I think we felt like that Ford was comfortably ahead, and our people out who were for Ford out in the counties and precincts thought that and didn't have a sense of urgency and didn't do a good job of getting the vote out.
Mm-hmm. What were the personal ramifications for you of that upset? Even at the level of your feelings, I wonder if I can answer.
Well, you know, your feelings get bruised, any question about that, because I hadn't lost many, hadn't lost any personally, but that was one of the few that I'd been involved with up to my neck that we didn't come out okay on, particularly when I thought in advance we were. You know, I'd done a lot of campaigns as chairman for people that I didn't think were going to win, and they didn't. That was just part of the job, but this was different. And at the same time, I still thought Ford was the best candidate, ended up going with his campaign team to Kansas City for the convention, and of course he was nominated, and I worked hard on the floor with some people from, you know, Mississippi was one of the key delegations, and I knew a bunch of their people, and I had a hand in that, and worked hard in the fall campaign for Ford. Went into Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia, Arkansas and Oklahoma for him, and was really disappointed when he didn't pull it out.
Let me ask about a few eventualities that never came to pass. There was some rumor around 75, early 76, that you might even end up as on the ticket as Ford's VP choice. There was talk, certainly, that if Ford prevailed in 76, a cabinet position was probably in the stars. There was also some talk, and I think you yourself made mention of this after the 76 primary loss, that you might even give some thought to challenging Helms in 78. Can you sort of talk me through your thinking about those various possibilities and how those events developed?
Let me take the last one first, because I don't ever remember thinking in my own mind I was going to take on Helms in a primary. Okay. There probably were some people talking about that, because that was a pretty bitter primary. But I guess I have always, because of the way I came into the party and worked up through it, always felt like that the party couldn't afford to throw away its incumbents very quickly. And it just didn't make any sense in that case. On the vice presidential thing, I never did think that was a realistic thing. Some of our staff folks just thought it'd be fine. And I think they encouraged Ford's folks to do some talking publicly about that as a possibility when he came into North Carolina. It made good headlines, but it didn't make political sense. Given where the electoral votes are, where Ford was from, I'm not sure Bob Dole was his best choice for vice president. I'd have probably gone with somebody from New York or California, or Ohio, perhaps. But I know he was serious enough about the cabinet thing that the FBI came in and started doing some investigating around, because several of the council state people, Democrats, said, FBI's being, told them I thought you'd do fine. But, and I guess if Ford had won, we'd have probably gone to Washington, and our lives since then would probably have been different and probably not as good.
Did Watergate play a significant role in the opening of this wedge between camps and the Republican Party?
I don't think it played a role at all. It definitely played a role in how things were going during that 2 to 3 year period in Washington and in Raleigh. I've told several people that I had a friend in Charlotte tell me that a Charlotte Observer reporter told him one time, says, "I know there's a Watergate in Raleigh if I can just find it." It got everybody into a mood of not trusting government, and you had to prove you're innocent every day almost. And it made the job of establishing credibility for yourself something I just never had to do before. You still had to start to go about it daily.
You'd expended some political capital in 73 placing Tom Bennett as state party chair, removing Frank Rouse, or, you know, backing Bennett so that at the convention he defeated Frank Rouse. how ideological motivated a move was that? Was that more sort of operational, if you will?
I think more operational. You recall that in 72, Rouse had backed Gardner in the primary, had resigned when he came out to do that, and during, when I say the primary, the second primary, he resigned as state chairman to announce his support for Gardner. and then came back and ran for state chairman at the executive committee meeting in June, and beat Ray Schroer, who'd been the vice chairman, stepped up as acting chairman. And we had not been pleased about that, but as it turned out, it's probably for the best thing, because it helped the pulling together process for everybody under that one umbrella for the fall. And sort of a funny thing, Frank and I never had a personal falling out, and still communicate a lot, and are friends. And same way with Jim Gardner. But at that particular time, our folks felt, and I tended to feel like, that we needed somebody in the state chairmanship that was sort of an extension of the governor's office. And that was the reason we asked Tom Bennett to run, partly because he had been a legislator, was familiar with Raleigh and the scene there, and was a lawyer, and very astute lawyer, I think, and did a good job as state chairman.
How close were you to Tom Bennett personally?
We had served together in the legislature, had worked hard together on bills and legislation, had gone out to dinner a lot. Mm-hmm. Our families knew each other, so it was a personal as well as a political level association.
After Helms' victory in 78, the party chairmanship goes over to the Helms camp, if you will. Can you tell me about those developments?
Well, there may have been a transition in there. My recollection is Bob Shaw was the next chairman, and Bob had certainly supported me and always has. And I think he was an acceptable person to everybody. And so there was that period, and the club got more and more involved in party affairs there for several years. Up to that time, their focus had been primarily on the national level. And I think there was a maturing that process that comes after you've been established a while, that you start to look around and see what other territories there are. And with Ford having lost in 70, excuse me, Ford having lost in 76, and then Reagan winning the 80 primary, and they haven't had such close ties with Reagan, it was sort of a natural movement there for a while.
How significant did you judge the club's success in getting John East elected?
A lot. John, one of the most astute men I've ever known. We had disagreed on a number of issues, but I had a great respect for him. He was very articulate. And started off with a name ID of probably minus one. They went out and raised the money for him and set him up on a campaign schedule that was totally fundraising. And put their TV out on basically the attack ads on the B-1 bomber and the Panama Canal, and just kept running them till all of us were so sick of them we couldn't stand it. And everybody kept telling them, change them, please. It's costing us votes, but the polls kept moving in the same direction. And Carter Wren told me that he was sick of them, but until the polls changed, he wasn't going to change. And they never did change and went right through. And at the same time, I didn't have a sense that the campaign was winning. I told President Ford, who was in Asheville on Friday or Saturday before the election, that I thought it was not going to win, and I was doing a commentary with Pat Taylor on Channel 3 or Channel 9 in Charlotte on election night, and the first thing I started noticing about 9 o'clock was that Senate race was much tighter than anybody expected, and I started making a prediction it was going to be a hairliner, which it turned out to be. And, of course, it was a big nationwide win for the Republicans to control the Senate.
Let me ask us to step back for a
and
moment.
Excuse me. I don't mean to take anything away from John East, but the strategy that the club put together for winning the campaign, and which he followed right down the line, obviously is a winning one. It doesn't mean it would have won every year, because there are some years in which you're not going to win no matter how well you do. And you can't get your feelings hurt too much by that. But in other years, the opportunity is there if you do your job right. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of how I felt about 72, and I felt about 80 also.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about, you mentioned that earlier in our conversation that the politics one sees today as against the politics of the 70s has a lot to do with changed circumstances and just reflects the changing terrain in the state and nation. How do you, stepping back away from the question sort of partisan politics, what do you think have been the most significant changes which have these political ramifications in North Carolina, say, over the last 15, 20 years? Economic changes, demographic changes, things like that.
Well, clearly, mobility for people has made society just different across the country. You don't have nearly as many people who are living in the same neighborhoods that they grew up in that you would have 50 years ago. And highways have made it different. Planes have made it different. And in-migration of industry into North Carolina has made it different. I'll sidetrack a little bit and talk about my testimony in a deposition involving the lawsuit on the election of Superior Court judges not long ago. The attorney for the state asked me if I thought the influx of industry had been the main thrust of Republicans in the last recent years, and I told him I thought it was really the rise in the literacy rate. But that was sort of a humorous aside between friends, because I knew the attorney well. Clearly, as people have moved in from outside North Carolina, from other areas where they were Republicans, they go ahead and register Republicans now. 30 years ago, they probably would have registered Democrats, because everybody was said, if you want to be involved locally, you better be a Democrat. I don't find that's the case anymore. And you find too that because of in the western part of the state, those seeds that were sown by Charlie Jonas and Jim Broyhill and Jim Martin and Earl Ruth and Vinegar Ben Mizell on those congressional waves, those Democrats organizations that worked for them, those folks gradually became Republicans. In the East, those people that started out to be Jessicrats have gradually become Republicans, mostly. And so there's been, with the passing of time, that's resulted in a lot of conservative Democrats and moderate conservative Democrats leaving the Democrat Party and coming to the Republican Party. It has made the Republican Party clearly a more viable contender in the state. It's also had a serious impact within the Democratic Party, and it's very hard for a moderate or conservative Democrat to win a primary anymore. And it's going to be interesting to see how that works, particularly in 1996 with the Senate race, I think. The Reagan years helped that along in North Carolina, I think, in the Bush years. I think that clearly was shown by the fact that in 1978, Jimmy Carter, as a Southerner, carried North Carolina, whereas in 1992, Bill Clinton, as a Southerner, didn't. And I think that reflects as much as anything what's happened in North Carolina.
What issues would you point to as being the most important ones bringing, say, Jessicrat voters over from the Democratic Party now to self-identification with the Republican Party?
Oh, it's It's always a little hard to know. You had Joe Califano beaten up on tobacco during Carter's term.
Oh, it's like a sector of AGW.
That's right. That's right. And I think it has been, in a sense, not as much what's been happening in the Republican Party as what's been happening within the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party rules change that George McGovern instituted, that probably ended up with his being the nominee, frankly, in 72, have left the Democratic Party almost hostage to its special interest groups. And it's increasing increasing visibility of those special interest groups has I think been done as much as anything to cause these people in North Carolina who've been Jessicrat types, or even if they weren't Jesse fans but were conservative Democrats, business people, get increasingly unhappy with the Democrats and think their party had left them.
Let me ask about reapportionment and its impact on realignment in North Carolina, and particularly the events of late, starting, say, with the whole experience of the Jingles case through the 80s and the question of redrawing districts here within North Carolina, and then subsequently the Shaw versus Reno and the congressional districts and so forth. How significant do you think reapportionment as it has played out per the 82 Voting Rights Act has been in this political realignment of late and the GOP's real tremendous success of late?
I think that has tended to maximize the results of the changes that we've been talking about. Had those factors not been in play, the results would not be as dramatic as they have been.
Mm-hmm.
I served through 4 redistricting sessions in the 60s and 71. Saw the games that get played with the maps. Learned enough to be able to take credit for drawing the congressional map in maybe it was 71, because I knew the Democrats who were going to want to protect their incumbent congressman, and gave them a map that did a better job of that than any other one, and it helped to select some Republicans. And those changes, though, that came as a result of the Voting Rights Act and the federal cases shoved everybody into a mindset that you weren't going to get things approved unless you did certain things. And with the Voting Rights Act affecting so many counties in the state, the natural result was that you carved up districts for blacks, or more likely to have blacks elected, both to Congress and to the state legislature, and in some cases county commissioners and city councilmen. And when you pull that normally Democrat black vote out of an at-large district and put what was left into a second district, what was left was more likely to be Republican. Still didn't go Republican in every case, but a lot of them did.
Governors, we head towards the end of our time, and I want to be respectful of our earlier agreement about the length. Let me ask for your broad summary assessments of the following several subjects. I'll ask you to sort of share your assessment of the key aspects of the evolution of black political activity in North Carolina since the Voting Rights Act, say, in 65, and the evolution of women's political activity in the state over those times. What landmarks stand out in your mind, what the broad trends have been. So if maybe you could describe your thoughts on black political activity over those times.
Well, clearly, before 1960, there just hadn't been much black involvement with politics. And the Voting Rights Act, and a lot of what happened during the Johnson administration, created a whole new opportunity for minority involvement. And it has varied from state to state as how that's come about. We still don't have statewide black elected officials in the executive branch. Haven't elected them statewide to Congress. But we do have some blacks on the courts that have been elected statewide. And it has definitely opened up the opportunities at the city and county and legislative levels. It's hard to know what is better for the minority community. In regard to the whole thing about these voting rights decisions and all, it may well be that they're better served by having more people have to depend on their vote to be involved, to get elected, and therefore they have a greater impact on those who are elected, rather than having a black person elected from a district. But with a formula that almost assures that they will be in a considerable minority. I think, though, that if you ask most black activists, they would say they'd rather have the person there. And so I take that as what they think. I think it has been healthy for the state to have blacks in visible positions. I told blacks